The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. Trapped by their own circumstances? According to the 16th century French essayist Michel de Montaigne, when three Indians from the coast of Brazil paid a visit to Charles IX of France in 1562, someone asked them what they thought of all this and what had they been most amazed by during their stay in France. The Indians, who knew no class division in their own society, have an idiom in their own language which calls all men halves of one another. And they observed that French society was divided into very unequal halves. They noticed, wrote Montaigne, that, quote, there were among us men fully bloated with all sorts of comforts, while their halves were begging at their doors, emaciated with poverty and hunger. They found it odd that those destitute halves should put up with such injustice and did not take the others by the throat or set fire to their houses. End quote. Transported to the United States in the 21st century, the Native Americans might have the same question. They would see a society where the richest fifth of Americans have 9 times more wealth than the poorest fifth. Why don't the vast majority, whose labor makes such obscene wealth possible, take the 1%, quote, by the throat or set fire to their houses? The answer, of course, is that rebellions and revolutions have occurred throughout history. However, it must be admitted that the oppressed are not in a permanent state of rebellion. Otherwise, capitalism would already have been overthrown. The answer that is usually given as to why workers have yet to achieve socialism is a very depressing one. In George Orwell's 1984, the main character, Winston, a low-level government bureaucrat beaten down by the all-seeing, all-knowing dictatorship of Big Brother, understands that the proles, the working class of Oceania, are the only hope if the system is to be overthrown. They needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse shaking off flies, Winston imagines. But Winston is full of despair, because apparently this is completely impossible. As he wanders through the streets of a working-class district, he hears loud shouts in the distance, imagining that it might be a protest, only to find a group of women fighting over a saucepan. Heavy physical work, wrote Orwell of the proles, the care of home and children, petty quarrels with neighbors, films, football, beer, and above all, gambling, filled up the horizon of their minds. In his secret diary, Winston describes the apparent dilemma that makes a workers' revolution impossible. Quote, until they become conscious, they will never rebel, and until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. It is no accident that 1984 is part of practically every high school curriculum. It reinforces what is a widespread prejudice in the United States, that workers are too divided, too distracted by bread and circuses, and too mentally limited to change the world. This bad caricature of the working class is widespread. It is an elitist view, to be sure, often argued by educated middle-class professionals and a ruling class who look down upon workers and think of themselves as too cultured and intelligent to ever be duped or hoodwinked. Except when it comes to blindly accepting the idea that the meek cannot inherit the earth. The truth is that workers hold all sorts of ideas about the world they live in. Some of those ideas express a rejection of the status quo. Others express acceptance of it, The system is buttressed ideologically on television, radio, in schools, in the newspapers, from the pulpit. Workers are encouraged to accept the ruling ideology that poverty, greed, racism, inequality, and war are products of immutable human nature, that workers are too uneducated, too stupid to run society, that only the well-born can rule, that revolutions end in tyranny, and that this, as preceptor Pangloss, the oracle of a baron, tells us in Voltaire's Candide, is the best of all possible worlds. One reason that ruling ideas can take hold at all is simply inertia. The inherent conservatism built into a set of human social relations once they are established. Society does not change its institutions as need arises, the way a mechanic changes his instruments, wrote Trotsky. On the contrary, society actually takes the institutions which hang upon it as given once for all. End quote. The state is always prepared to resort to legal repression and even armed force if it is threatened. But for much of the time, force isn't necessary to maintain order. So long as a majority of people give their passive consent to the status quo, force isn't necessary. In order to change society, workers must become conscious of their position as the oppressed class and organize themselves as a class to fight for their own interests. According to Orwell's Winston, this is impossible. According to historical experience, it is not. Consciousness is not static or fixed simply because the bosses wish it were. Workers are not automatons that accept all the ruling ideas of society without question. If that were true, all radical change would be impossible. Workers accept the everyday common sense ideas, that is, ideas that reinforce existing conditions, as well as ideas that challenge them. To quote the Italian revolutionary Antonio Gramsci, a worker actually carries in his or her head two contradictory consciousnesses, quote, one which is implicit in his activity and which in reality unites him with all his fellow workers in the practical transformation of the real world, and one superficially explicit or verbal, which he has inherited from the past and uncritically absorbed. End quote. This contradiction is a reflection of the fact that capitalism both divides and unites workers. That is, it brings them together in large numbers, and at the same time fosters competition between them. Competition separates individuals from one another, not only the bourgeois, but still more the workers, wrote Marx and Engels. Quote, in spite of the fact that it brings them together, hence it is a long time before these individuals can unite. To demand the opposite would be tantamount to demanding that competition should not exist in this definite epoch of history, or that the individuals should banish from their minds relationships over which in their isolation they have no control. End quote. Workers are forced to fight back, to stop a wage or benefit cut, to fight against a draconian labor law, or, for undocumented workers, to fight for amnesty. Hal Draper, a U.S. socialist who wrote an excellent series of books on Marx's ideas, wrote, quote, to engage in class struggle, it is not necessary to believe in the class struggle any more than it is necessary to believe in Newton in order to fall from an airplane. The working class moves towards class struggle insofar as capitalism fails to satisfy its economic and social needs and aspirations, not insofar as it is told about struggle by Marxists. End quote. In the course of struggle, the gap between workers' own experience and the ruling ideas widens to the point where workers begin to reject them. The ruling ideas begin to break down. In big struggles, these ideas break down very quickly. A strike, wrote Lenin, opens the eyes of the workers to the nature not only of the capitalists, but of the government and the laws as well. The important thing is that a group of workers decides to take action. When they do, their experience opens their eyes to the truth, which in turn gives them more confidence to fight. Workers who strike quickly learn that the police and courts are set up against them and for the employers, and also that the press defends employers and tries to present workers' interests in a bad light. One struggle gives heart to another's struggle, and one struggle piggybacks on another. It is the fight against suffering and exploitation, rather than suffering itself, that transforms consciousness. In isolation or defeat, workers are more easily prone to turn their suffering and bitterness on each other, or on scapegoats. But the experience of struggle teaches solidarity to workers, calling into question divisions of race, sex, and nationality that are deliberately fostered between them by the ruling class. They learn that whenever the employers or the state can pit them against each other, they are weak, and when they unite, they are strong. They learn that if any part of the working class or oppressed is held down, it makes it easier for the bosses to hold all workers down. Socialism doesn't come about through education. No matter how much propaganda socialists put out, it wouldn't be enough to convince everyone to be socialists. This would, of course, be preferable. We'd simply send out a series of chain letters explaining why we need to reorganize society along rational lines, and eventually we'd reach everyone. Revolution wouldn't even be necessary because the vast majority would simply say to the exploiting minority, "Your time is up." Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. For one thing, the bourgeoisie has control of the mass media and can always reach more people. In fact, it is primarily struggle that teaches. As Lenin noted, quote, "When bourgeois gentry and their uncritical echoers, the social reformists, talk about the education of the masses, they usually mean something schoolmasterly, pedantic. The real education of the masses can never be separated from their independent political, and especially revolutionary, struggle. Only struggle educates the exploited class. Only struggle discloses to it the magnitude of its own power, widens its horizon, enhances its abilities, clarifies its mind, and forges its will." End quote. It was this concept that prompted Marx to remark, "Every step of real movement is more important than a dozen programs." That is why in periods of relative calm, when there is little struggle, the possibility of fundamental change seems remote. But beneath the inertia are molecular processes that are creating the dry conditions in which a spark can ignite the tinder and cause a conflagration. It is in fact partly the natural conservatism of mind, the way in which people cling to old ideas long after they make sense, that gives rise to social explosions. As Trotsky concluded from his participation in the Russian Revolution, quote, the swift changes of mass views and moods in an epoch of revolution, derived not from the flexibility and mobility of man's mind, but just from the opposite, from its deep conservatism. The chronic lag of ideas and relations behind new objective conditions, right up to the moment when the latter crash over people in the form of a catastrophe, is what creates in a period of revolution that leaping movement of ideas and passions, which seem to the police mind a mere result of the activities of demagogues. End quote. A statement issued by the founding meeting of the United Shoras, Iranian Workers' Councils, in March 1979, after the fall of the Shah, shows the way in which revolutionary struggles raises the working class up and makes it the leader of all the oppressed. "We, the workers of Iran," the statement began, "through our strikes, sit-ins, and demonstrations, overthrew the Shah." Workers of Iran put up with privation and death in order to create an Iran free from repression, free of exploitation. "We made the revolution in order to end unemployment and homelessness, to replace the Savak, the Shah's secret police, oriented syndicate with independent workers' shoras, formed by the workers of each factory for their own economic and political needs." End quote. Among the statement's demands were free healthcare, housing benefits, an end to the intervention of armed forces to break up strikes, and free nursery services at work. Farrell Dobbs, a Trotskyist worker who played a leading role in the 1934 Minneapolis Teamsters strike, one of the most important rank-and-file-led strikes of the era, answered the naysayers against workers' capacity for struggle like this. Quote, "Wiseacres of the day spoke pontificately about the passivity of the working class, never understanding that the seeming docility of the workers at a given time is a relative thing. If workers are more or less holding their own in daily life and expecting that they can get ahead slowly, they want to radicalize. Things are different when they are losing ground and the future looks precarious to them. Then a change begins to occur in their attitude, which is not always immediately apparent. The tinder of discontent begins to pile up. Any spark can light it, and once lit, the fire can spread rapidly." End of chapter 5.